Welcome back to The Critique. Today, we're reviewing a marriage course transcript that's focused on revitalizing a couple's sexual relationship through communication and prioritization.
Yeah, a really important topic.
Definitely. But while the source material is, you know, structured and well-intentioned, we need to immediately pivot into refining its psychological accuracy, modernizing its analogies, and ensuring it safely addresses the really complex realities of trauma, coercion, and betrayal.
Right, because the stakes are just so high with this kind of material.
Exactly. So let's jump right in. A deeply vulnerable topic requires an opening that immediately grounds the listener in empathetic reality rather than relying on historical anecdotes and mechanical analogies.
Oh, completely.
Because right now, the text begins with this this extended, somewhat dated joke about Neil Armstrong and a Mr. Gorski.
Yeah, the one with the neighbor yelling through the window about withholding sex, right?
Right. And then immediately after that, it transitions into an analogy that compares a couple's sex life to pulling the starter rope on a broken lawnmower.
Wow.
I know. The fundamental weakness here is just the jarring tonal dissonance this creates right out of the gate.
It really creates a massive barrier to entry, doesn't it? I mean, when we look at the demographic for a curriculum dedicated to revitalizing physical intimacy, we have to assume a significant portion of these readers are arriving at page one feeling a profound sense of desperation.
Right.
They are heartbroken, you know, they're lonely in their own beds, and they might be entirely disconnected from their partner. So to open a book carrying that level of emotional weight and be greeted with a joke about an angry wife withholding intimacy.
Exactly.
Until a kid walks on the moon. Yeah.
Exactly. It just introduces the topic through this lens of transaction, frustration, and like eavesdropping.
It reads like defensive humor to me, like it's deflecting the tension rather than holding space for it. But I do wonder, I can see what they're going for with the spark plug imagery, you know, the idea of clearing away the grime so a spark can return. But does comparing human intimacy to pulling a starter rope on a cold engine inadvertently set the wrong psychological stage for a couple already feeling fundamentally broken?
I think it absolutely does. Because when you use an analogy like a broken lawnmower, you are inherently communicating that one partner or the relationship itself is a machine that is currently defective.
Ah, yeah, defective. That's a strong word to internalize.
Right. And it implies a linear, predictable, mechanical equation. And how do we fix defective machines? We do it through force, through tinkering, through the repetitive yanking of a cord until the engine finally catches.
Just forcing it to work?
Yeah. If you are a reader whose body has completely shut down its sexual responses due to chronic stress, or, you know, if you've been feeling profoundly rejected for years, hearing that you just need to have your spark plug wiped is incredibly minimizing.
Oh, for sure.
It reduces a deeply psychological and physiological vulnerability into a mere maintenance task.
It literally turns intimacy into a chore before the reader has even reached the second chapter.
Exactly.
So the suggestion here, the pivot we need, is to replace the historical trivia and mechanical analogies with a realistic, relatable scenario that directly mirrors the target audience's actual lived experience. We need to immediately validate their struggles.
Yes. Opening with immediate visceral empathy is far more effective than trying to entertain. The goal of an introduction in a therapeutic text is to create a secure psychological container for the work ahead.
So, for a concrete example, instead of the moon landing joke, this text could open with a vivid vignette of a modern couple.
Okay, yeah, paint that picture.
Like, picture them staring at the ceiling after a long day of parenting or working. They're acutely aware of the physical distance between them in bed, maybe listening to the hum of the air conditioner, and they desperately want to reach out, but they're paralyzed by the fear of rejection.
Oh, wow. Yeah, a vignette like that captures the reader's trust instantly. The reader exhales and thinks, you know, this author sees me.
They know my bedroom.
Right. They know exactly the silence that exists in my bedroom. You just don't need to break the ice with a joke if you can melt it with accurate, profound empathy. It normalizes the quiet agony of the situation without making light of it.
And then, as a concrete replacement for the lawnmower analogy, the material could use the imagery of tending to a delicate garden in changing seasons.
Oh, I like that.
right? It's something organic that requires entirely different types of nourishment depending on the emotional weather.
The garden analogy is brilliant because it shifts the entire locus of control and the perception of the problem. Like, a garden isn't a machine you can force into blooming.
No, you can't yank a flower open.
Exactly. If it isn't yielding flowers, you don't pull on the stems. You evaluate the environment. You look at the soil composition, the sunlight, the ambient temperature, the water levels. By shifting from a lawnmower to an organic ecosystem, you implicitly communicate to the reader that their lack of intimacy isn't a mechanical failure.
Or a personal defect.
Yeah, it's just a natural response to their current environmental conditions.
That framing completely removes the blame. If the engine won't start, the engine is broken. But if the garden isn't blooming, it just happens to be winter, or there's a drought.
The conditions need to be addressed, not the innate worthiness of the plant. And this is vital for couples who are stuck in a cycle of blame. Usually, one partner feels like a failure because they have no desire, and the other feels like a failure because they can't elicit the desire.
So true.
The mechanical analogy reinforces that dynamic of failure. But the ecological analogy of the garden gives them a shared project. It asks, how do we improve the soil of our relationship? It moves them to the same side of the table.
Yeah, it's a team effort now. Which brings us perfectly to our next point. The physiological and emotional mechanics of intimacy are best served by focusing on individual desire profiles rather than relying on broad binary gender stereotypes.
Uh-oh. Let me guess, the text leans into stereotypes.
Oh, heavily. The weakness here is that as we move into the chapters detailing arousal, it highlights a diagram portraying men as a simple on-off switch and women as complicated wiring that changes every 2 weeks.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and it further implies that men are essentially always ready for sex, while women require core completion, specifically mentioning washing up, as a prerequisite for arousal.
Yikes.
It's a massive oversimplification. It alienates couples whose dynamics do not fit this traditional mold, and frankly, it just ignores modern, evidence-based psychological understandings of human desire. But I mean, that quote is clearly laid out in the text. A man cannot be a good lover unless he's helped with the washing up.
Right.
I have to ask, though, is there a risk that focusing solely on core-based transactional intimacy might overlook the deeper, more complex emotional and psychological factors that drive female and, frankly, male desire?
There is an immense risk. Relying on the, you know, men are microwaves, women are crockpot style of analogies, or that switch versus switchboard diagram, it does a massive disservice to the complex reality of human neurobiology. We have to look at the collateral damage of these stereotypes.
What do you mean by collateral damage?
Well, by implying that a man is just a simple on-off switch who is perpetually ready for sex, the text completely invalidates the experience of a man who is exhausted, depressed, struggling with his body image, or simply needing emotional reassurance before he can feel physically aroused.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. If a man in that situation reads this text, he internalizes the message that he is somehow less of a man because he doesn't fit the always-on archetype. He looks at the diagram, sees the single switch, realizes his own experience is much more complex, and concludes that he is the anomaly.
That's heartbreaking, really.
And conversely, look at how this defines female arousal, defining it primarily through the lens of completed household chores. This idea that if a husband just takes out the rubbish and washes the dishes, his wife will automatically be ready for intimacy. It turns female sexual desire into a transactional reward system. It flattens her humanity, just as much as the on-off switch flattens his.
Yeah, it reduces her desire to a chore chart.
Exactly. Now we have to differentiate between removing a stressor and introducing an aphrodisiac. An equitable division of labor is absolutely essential for marital satisfaction. I mean, if someone is drowning in household management, they're going to be too exhausted and resentful for intimacy.
Obviously.
But doing the dishes is not inherently erotic. Doing the dishes simply clears the baseline of resentment. It takes a foot off the brake pedal, but it does not press the accelerator.
So the suggestion here is to adopt an evidence-aware framework that applies universally, regardless of gender. The material needs to focus on the concepts of spontaneous versus responsive desire and the dual control model of sexual response.
Yes, the dual control model is the perfect replacement for the switchboard diagram. Modern sexology, heavily popularized by researchers like Emily Nagoski, tells us that arousal relies on a dual control system in the central nervous system.
Okay, break that down for us.
Sure. So everyone has a sexual excitation system, the accelerator, which notices sexually relevant stimuli in the environment and sends the signal to turn on. And everyone has a sexual inhibition system, the brake pedal, which notices all the reasons why right now is a bad time for sex.
Like what?
Stress, danger, anxiety, a massive pile of unwashed dishes, fear of pregnancy, body insecurities, these all hit the brake pedal.
So the messy house isn't a lack of an accelerator, it is a heavy foot on the brake.
Exactly. And this framework applies to all genders. A man facing extreme pressure at work has a heavy foot on his brake pedal. A woman dealing with a crying toddler has a heavy foot on hers.
Right, right.
The partner washing the dishes doesn't magically press the accelerator, it merely takes the foot off the brake. You still have to figure out what actually presses the accelerator for that unique individual once the brakes are cleared.
That is such a healthier way to look at it. So as a concrete example to replace those outdated gender diagrams, the authors should provide a tool where both partners, regardless of gender, map their own unique brakes and accelerators.
I love that exercise.
Yeah, they could sit down and list what inhibits them. Work stress, feeling unheard, a cluttered bedroom, and then what stimulates them. Like non-sexual touch, shared laughter, intellectual stimulation, or even just a specific text message during the day.
By teaching couples to map their specific accelerators and brakes, you give them a highly tailored, evidence-based tool that respects their individuality. It facilitates a much richer conversation than, I did the dishes, why aren't you in the mood?
Oh, totally.
It allows a partner to say, I know you've had a brutal week at work, which is a massive break for you. What can we do to help your nervous system transition out of that stress state?
And it seamlessly introduces the concept of spontaneous versus responsive desire. The text currently frames responsive desire, you know, the idea of needing to warm up, as a uniquely female trait wrapped up in that complicated wiring metaphor.
Which is biologically inaccurate. Spontaneous desire is what we typically see in early courtship or in the movies. Desire appearing out of the blue, seemingly unprompted, usually driven by the novelty of a new relationship and high levels of dopamine.
That is so common, though.
Right. Responsive desire, however, means that desire doesn't emerge until after the context is highly pleasurable and arousal has already physically begun. You don't feel hungry until you smell the food cooking.
That is so common, though. Responsive desire is incredibly common in long-term relationships for all genders.
It is often the default setting for long-term monogamy. If the material normalizes that anyone can have responsive desire and that it is a perfectly healthy, standard way for a human body to operate, it removes an incredible amount of shame.
So to ground this for the reader, the text should provide a concrete, realistic scenario of a husband who experiences responsive desire.
Yes, absolutely.
A scenario where he needs a relaxing evening, deep conversation, and non-sexual physical affection before he feels any spark of desire. Normalizing this dynamic for the reader would just be a game changer for couples who feel like they're failing because the husband doesn't fit the always ready stereotype and the wife doesn't fit the transactional chore stereotype.
It gives them an accurate map of the territory. When a couple understands that one or both of them operate on responsive desire, the lack of spontaneous initiation is no longer interpreted as a lack of love or attraction. It is simply understood as their nervous system's operating system.
Well said. But this actually brings us to a highly sensitive intersection regarding how that responsive desire is enacted.
Okay. Where does the text go wrong here?
Well, presenting sexual responsiveness as a conscious decision or a gift to a partner must be carefully balanced with explicit safeguards against emotional coercion.
I see where this is going.
Yeah. The weakness in this section is the suggestion that individuals, particularly women, should make a deliberate choice to engage in sex even when tired or not initially aroused.
Okay, that's a delicate topic.
Very. And the text supports this with a survey quote where a husband claims that saying no to sex is saying no to me as I am.
Wow. Okay, this is where the material walks onto incredibly thin ice. The core idea that you can choose to be responsive, that you can allow yourself to warm up to the idea of intimacy even if you don't feel an initial spark, is technically the essence of navigating responsive desire in a healthy relationship.
Right.
But the context in which this text presents it is highly problematic. When you quote a spouse saying, "When she says no, it is saying no to me as I am," you are framing sexual refusal not as a boundary regarding one's own body, but as a fundamental rejection of the partner's personhood.
It elevates the stakes of a simple refusal to an existential crisis. Like, if I say no to sex because I have a migraine, or I'm simply exhausted, I am now being told that I am actually rejecting my partner's soul.
And that is a subtle but potent form of emotional coercion. It tells the reader that they are entirely responsible for their partner's psychological stability, and that the only way to maintain that stability is to offer their body, regardless of their own physical or emotional state.
Yeah. In high-conflict relationships, or dynamics with a history of boundary pushing, this advice can easily be weaponized. It inadvertently places the burden of a partner's self-esteem on the other's sexual availability, blurring the lines of autonomy and risking a dynamic of mere compliance rather than genuine connection.
Definitely. If a reader is in a relationship where boundaries have historically been ignored or where there's an undercurrent of manipulation, reading this text gives the coercive partner ammunition.
They can literally point to the book.
Yes. They can say, "Look, the experts say you should make a deliberate choice to meet my needs. Otherwise, you're damaging my self-esteem." It creates an environment where the lower desire partner yields out of fear, guilt, or a desire to manage their partner's moods. That is compliance, not connection.
But let's build on that point for a second, because I want to look at it from the perspective of a partner who has experienced boundary violations.
Okay.
The text clearly lays out the pain of the initiating partner feeling rejected. But how can this material guide a couple to navigate the pain of rejection without making the refusing partner feel guilty or entirely responsible for the other's emotional well-being?
By drawing a hard, bright line between healthy willingness and fearful compliance. The suggestion here is that the text needs to clearly differentiate between healthy, responsive desire in an emotionally safe relationship versus harmful compliance in an unsafe or coercive one. They need to explicitly introduce the vital concept of enthusiastic consent.
Okay, so a concrete example would be adding a distinct caveat section, explicitly stating that responsive choice only applies in relationships entirely free of emotional coercion, manipulation, or abuse.
The text must state that choosing to lean into intimacy when you are tired is only a beautiful connecting act if you know, with absolute certainty, that you have the complete freedom to say no without facing punishment.
Without punishment.
If you say no, and your partner responds with sulking, passive aggression, a prolonged guilt trip, or the silent treatment, then your no is not safe. And if your no is not safe, your yes is not truly consensual. It is a survival strategy to keep the peace.
That is such a vital distinction.
The material desperately needs to articulate that if one partner punishes the other emotionally for saying no, the environment is toxic to true intimacy. The burden is on the initiating partner to handle rejection with emotional maturity, not on the refusing partner to manage the initiator's ego.
And for couples who are caught in that anxious cycle of initiation and rejection, a great concrete exercise the authors could suggest is establishing a low-pressure touch protocol.
Oh, that is a phenomenal circuit breaker. Because what happens in strained dynamics is that the lower desire partner starts avoiding all physical contact.
Right, they pull away completely.
They won't sit on the couch next to their spouse. They won't hold hands. They won't offer a hug in the kitchen because they are terrified that any physical contact will be interpreted as an invitation for sex. They are anticipating the escalation and trying to preemptively shut it down.
It's a completely defensive posture. And then, of course, the higher desire partner feels even more starved for affection, interpreting the lack of casual touch as further rejection.
Exactly. It creates a downward spiral of physical isolation. So the low-pressure touch protocol creates a controlled, safe environment to reintroduce physical affection.
How does it work?
The couple explicitly agrees upon a time frame. For example, for the next 2 weeks, we are going to cuddle on the couch for 15 minutes a night,
and sex is completely off the table. It is absolutely not going to happen no matter what.
That completely removes the anxiety of compliance for the lower desire partner by guaranteeing the boundary that it will not escalate unless mutually and explicitly requested. Their nervous system can actually relax.
They can finally enjoy the physical warmth and connection without guarding their boundaries. They don't have to stay vigilant. It rebuilds the foundation of safe physical intimacy. But, crucially,
there's a catch.
There is. This exercise only works if the higher desire partner possesses the emotional maturity to respect that boundary without resentment. If they spend those 15 minutes sighing heavily or trying to push the boundary, the exercise backfires and trust is further eroded. It requires absolute adherence to the agreed-upon limits.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, let's shift gears slightly to something even heavier. Addressing the restoration of sexual intimacy requires a much deeper, more scientifically grounded roadmap when serious trauma, abuse, or massive trust violations are present.
Yeah, this is a critical area.
The weakness in the source material is that it only briefly touches on past negative sexual experiences, abuse, and unfaithfulness.
Briefly.
Very briefly. And it advises couples to get some help or to choose to forgive because, and this is quoting a therapist in the text, holding grudges kills desire.
Oh no. This is perhaps the most clinically dangerous section of the manuscript. It effectively treats deep psychological trauma and severe betrayal as simple roadblocks that can be cleared with a quick cognitive choice.
Yeah, it conflates everyday marital annoyances with profound trauma. Like, the argument that holding grudges kills desire makes logical sense for everyday frustrations. If I'm mad that you left your dirty socks on the floor again, holding onto that grudge will probably dampen my desire for intimacy that evening.
Sure, of course.
But applying that same logic to an affair or a history of abuse seems to short-circuit the necessary grieving and accountability process. I mean, could the advice to quickly forgive and let go actually cause further damage?
It absolutely short-circuits the process and can do profound psychological damage. When a massive trust violation occurs, like infidelity, hidden financial ruin, or emotional abuse, the betrayed partner doesn't just experience cognitive anger. They experience physiological trauma.
The body reacts.
Yes. The autonomic nervous system registers their partner not as a safe haven, but as a predator or a source of existential danger.
The alarm bells are constantly ringing in the background. The body is literally stuck in fight, flight, or freeze.
Exactly. The concept of neuroception, which is our brain's subconscious scanning of the environment for safety or threat, is entirely disrupted. So when a curriculum tells a betrayed partner that they just need to choose to forgive and let go of the past so they can get back to having a healthy sex life, it is gaslighting the reality of their nervous system. You cannot cognitively command a traumatized brainstem to feel safe.
It places the burden of healing entirely on the victim's ability to suppress their natural survival instincts. It's asking them to build a roof over a house that has a shattered foundation.
That is the perfect way to look at it. You cannot bypass the structural repair of the relationship. Forgiveness, especially in the wake of trauma or betrayal, is not an event. It is not a switch you flip to restore intimacy. It is a grueling, non-linear process that demands rigorous, verifiable, and consistent behavioral change from the person who caused the harm.
They have to prove it.
The offending partner has to demonstrate over and over again through their actions that they are trustworthy.
If the text pressures the betrayed partner into resuming sexual vulnerability before that baseline safety is reestablished, it is essentially encouraging them to repeatedly re-traumatize themselves.
They will dissociate during intimacy. Their body will keep the score, leading to even deeper physical aversions and psychological distress down the line. So the suggestion for this section is to drastically expand it to acknowledge the physiological reality of trauma responses, specifically the autonomic nervous system's role in detecting safety. The text needs to provide intermediate, heavily scaffolded steps for rebuilding baseline safety before sexual vulnerability can even be discussed.
So, for concrete examples, the authors must replace the advice to simply let go of the past through choosing to forgive with a practical acknowledgement that healing from betrayal is a non-linear process requiring verifiable behavioral change. And as an actionable tool a couple can use this week, the text should introduce the concept of containment conversations.
Containment conversations are a vital clinical tool for the immediate aftermath of a severe trust violation.
How do they work?
Well, when a major betrayal is uncovered, the instinct is to talk about it all day, every day. The hurt partner is flooded with adrenaline, they want to ask 1,000 questions, they want to process the pain continuously.
Which is completely understandable.
It is, but the tension is suffocating and the entire ecosystem of the marriage becomes nothing but the betrayal. The trauma consumes all available oxygen.
So instead of expecting immediate sexual vulnerability or demanding a quick forgiveness, couples schedule structured, time-boxed conversations.
Right. For example, they agree to discuss the hurt for 20 minutes on a Tuesday and a Thursday evening. Containment puts boundaries around the chaos. During that specific time, the betrayed partner can ask questions, express anger, and process the grief. And the offending partner's only job is to listen non-defensively and offer empathy. They don't argue back, they witness the pain they caused.
And when the 20 minutes are up?
They close the box. They intentionally pivot back to the mundane reality of running their shared life. They make dinner, they do the laundry, they watch a television show, they act civilly toward one another.
That sounds incredibly difficult, but also necessary.
It gives the nervous system a desperately needed break. It allows the couple to experience moments of neutrality. In the wake of trauma, neutrality is the necessary stepping stone to safety, and safety is the necessary stepping stone to eventual intimacy. By adding this concept to the material, you provide a highly practical clinical tool that respects the magnitude of betrayal rather than insulting the reader with a platitude about choosing to let it go.
It honors the severity of the wound while providing a sterile environment to treat it, ensuring the rest of the week is focused on establishing non-sexual stability.
Exactly.
Okay, let's move to our final area of focus, which looks at the overarching motivation the material provides for maintaining this intimacy. The strategies for protecting a relationship's longevity are much more effective when framed around mutual emotional cultivation rather than fear-based transactional affair proofing.
Oh, the concept of affair proofing a marriage is an incredibly pervasive and incredibly damaging trope in relationship literature.
Yeah, it really is. The weakness here is that the final chapters frame keeping sex alive and meeting emotional needs primarily as a mechanism to affair-proof the marriage. The text uses an anecdote of a woman whose email relationship nearly destroyed her marriage, framing the narrative around the fact that she had stopped communicating with her husband.
I hate that framing.
It inadvertently places the responsibility for a partner's fidelity on the other partner's ability to constantly satisfy them sexually and emotionally.
It carries an underlying tone of threat. It implies that if you don't meet these needs perfectly, your partner's infidelity is a natural, almost justified consequence of your failure. It suggests a transactional formula, you know? If person A provides enough sex, enough validation, and enough emotional support, then person B will not cheat.
But clinically and historically, that is fundamentally untrue.
Fundamentally? People cheat for a myriad of reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with their partner's adequacy. They cheat due to narcissism, self-sabotage, unresolved childhood trauma, a sense of entitlement, or a desperate desire for escapism or novelty.
You can have a spouse who meets every single one of your needs, who communicates flawlessly and maintains a vibrant sex life, and that spouse can still make the autonomous, destructive choice to step outside the marriage.
Exactly. By framing the maintenance of the relationship as an affair-proofing mechanism, the text subtly shifts the blame for an affair onto the betrayed partner. It creates a paradigm where, if infidelity occurs, the immediate question is, well, what were you not providing at home? Did you not keep the spark alive?
It is textbook victim blaming. The anecdote about the woman with the email affair highlights this flawed causality perfectly. I mean, the takeaway shouldn't be that she nearly destroyed her marriage because she stopped communicating with her husband. The causality is backward. She chose to seek external validation, she chose to cross an ethical boundary, and as a result of funneling her emotional energy outside the marriage, she withdrew from her husband.
It's just so frustrating to read.
Right? Is the connection between a lack of communication at home and the inevitability of an affair fully established in the material, or is that an area to potentially bolster by emphasizing absolute personal accountability alongside relationship maintenance? It seems like it turns intimacy into a hostage situation. Sleep with me and talk to me, or I might wander.
It absolutely turns it into a hostage situation. It's fear-based compliance, not love. The suggestion here is that the material must shift the paradigm entirely from defensive affair-proofing to the proactive, positive pursuit of relationship vitality and individual integrity. We want couples to invest in their sex life and their emotional connection because it brings them joy, because it deepens their bond, and because it makes their shared life richer. We do not want them doing it because they are terrified the other person will leave if they slip up.
So for concrete examples of this shift, the authors must adjust the language and framing to emphasize that fidelity is a strict individual ethical boundary and a personal choice, not a reward for a spouse successfully meeting all needs.
Fidelity is established as an uncompromising personal ethic. I choose to be faithful because of my own integrity, not because you earned my fidelity today by being a good partner.
That removes the threat entirely.
It does. It allows the couple to build their connection on a foundation of mutual respect and personal honor rather than anxiety and transactional performance.
Furthermore, the material could include an exercise where couples define their external boundaries together, such as how they handle emotional intimacy with coworkers. However, they should do this not out of a fear of the other cheating, but as a unified front to protect their shared energy.
Framing is everything here. How do we have couples discuss things like workplace interactions without it feeling like they are just setting up guard towers to watch each other? We frame the boundary as a protective wall around something incredibly valuable that belongs to both of them.
I love that.
Instead of saying, "You can't text your coworker after 8 p.m. because I don't trust you," the conversation becomes, "Our emotional energy as a couple is a finite and precious resource. Let's agree on how we protect that resource from being drained by outside influences."
It becomes a unified front protecting the garden rather than two wardens patrolling a perimeter. And when you remove that anxiety, ironically, the intimacy flows much more naturally. You aren't tending the garden because you are terrified the homeowner will evict you. You are tending the garden because you want to sit among the flowers.
It changes the entire emotional weather of the relationship from fear to cultivation.
Beautifully put. Well, let's briefly recap the core narrative of our critique today. We looked at how to deeply strengthen this material by grounding the introduction in empathetic reality rather than relying on mechanical jokes and lawnmower analogies. We discussed evolving past binary, stereotype-driven models of arousal into an evidence-based understanding of individual desire profiles, specifically focusing on the realities of spontaneous versus responsive desire.
Right, moving away from the microwave and crockpot.
Exactly. We also highlighted the critical need to implement safeguards regarding consent and responsiveness to clearly differentiate healthy willingness from emotional coercion. We explored the absolute necessity of treating trauma and betrayal with clinical nuance, understanding the nervous system's role in safety, and avoiding the trap of premature cognitive forgiveness. And finally, we looked at reframing the fear-based concept of affair-proofing into the mutual proactive cultivation of a relationship based on personal integrity and shared boundaries.
To summarize the actionable tools we suggested for these transitions, we strongly recommend utilizing the accelerators and brakes mapping exercise to replace the gendered wiring diagrams, giving couples a tailored, evidence-based tool for understanding their unique arousal contexts. We also suggest establishing low-pressure touch protocols to break the cycle of rejection and anxiety, allowing the nervous system to relax without the threat of escalation.
And the containment conversations.
Yes, advising the implementation of containment conversations as a vital scaffolding tool for couples navigating the aftermath of betrayal, ensuring they can establish baseline safety while appropriately processing the trauma.
Absolutely. We warmly invite the listener to implement these high-level editorial shifts and submit their revised work back in for further constructive critique. Your material is tackling one of the most profound, vulnerable aspects of the human experience. By refining these psychological nuances, its impact can be truly transformational. When you view intimacy not as an engine to be pole-started, but as a delicate ecosystem to be understood and nurtured, you finally give couples the tools to step out of the cold mechanics of obligation and into the warmth of genuine connection. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.